Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Healthcare and the Anti-Injunction Act Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On March 26, 2012, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services versus Florida, which is one of the three cases before the court involving the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act of 2010, sometimes referred to as Obamacare or the Health Care Act. This case presents the question whether the Anti-Injunction Act prohibits a challenge to the validity of the Health Care Act until certain provisions take effect in 2014. This case also presents the question whether Congress has the power under the Constitution to require that virtually all Americans either obtain health insurance or pay a penalty. This requirement is commonly referred to as the individual mandate and will be the subject of a separate podcast. To discuss the anti-injunction issue, we have Kevin Walsh, who is an assistant professor of law at the University of Richmond Law School, and Steve Johnson, who is a professor at the Florida State University College of Law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. And now, Professor Walsh.
This is Kevin Walsh of the University of Richmond Law School, and I'd like to start this podcast on the Anti-Injunction Act arguments by first giving a history, a little bit of an overview of where the arguments came from in the litigation, and then what those arguments are. So the Anti-Injunction Act is an old statute that's been on the books since 1867, generally provides a pay first, litigate later approach to challenging taxes. It states that, quote, no suit for the purpose of restraining the assessment or collection of any tax shall be maintained in any court by any person, and so on. The federal government invoked the Anti-Injunction Act in its motions to dismiss the challenges that were brought immediately after the health care legislation was enacted. The government lost every single time in the district courts when it invoked the Anti-Injunction Act as a bar to challenging the mandate and the penalty that enforces the mandate. And they eventually gave up on the arguments, and the issue seemed to peter out. The first sign that the Anti-Injunction Act might be a live issue came with a decision of the Fourth Circuit, which dismissed the Liberty University case on the basis of the Anti-Injunction Act. And this was, of course, significant because the Fourth Circuit reached out to do this, even though there was no party before it actually arguing that the Anti-Injunction Act was a problem. And then later there was a vigorous dissent by Judge Kavanaugh of the D.C. Circuit from a decision to reach the constitutional merits, and Judge Kavanaugh added some further arguments for why the Anti-Injunction Act was a problem to the courts reaching the issue. So when the cases went up to the Supreme Court, the court granted cert out of the 11th Circuit case, which didn't address the Anti-Injunction Act at all, and because the federal government had changed its position on the Anti-Injunction Act and argued that it did not apply, and because the challengers continued to maintain also that it did not apply, the Supreme Court appointed an amicus curiae, Robert Long of Covington and Burling, to argue that the Anti-Injunction Act did, in fact, bar consideration of a pre-enforcement challenge. Mr. Long's lead argument before the court was that the Anti-Injunction Act is jurisdictional and therefore must be addressed by the court, even though the federal government had argued that it did not apply to the case. On the merits, Mr. Long offered two principal arguments for why the Anti-Injunction Act barred the court's consideration. First was an argument from the text of the health care law itself. And the details are not terribly important at this point, but basically a couple of provisions in that law taken together say that the penalty in Section 5000 Cap A, which is the mandate provision, that penalty shall be assessed and collected in the same manner as taxes. So the argument goes that because the Anti-Injunction Act speaks directly to the means of assessment and collection by prohibiting pre-collection judicial interference, that kind of interference must also be prohibited with respect to the health care law penalty. In other words, that equal treatment must be given so that the penalty is, in fact, assessed and collected in the same manner as taxes. And the second argument on the merits offered by the amicus curiae was that the penalty itself counted as a tax for purposes of the Anti-Injunction Act. So those were the main arguments offered for the applicability of the Anti-Injunction Act. Now, the federal government argued in response that Congress simply did not intend for challenges to the penalty to be subject to the Anti-Injunction Act. And the government's argument was a very narrow one, focused almost entirely on the intent of the Congress that enacted the health care law. The federal government did agree, though, that the Anti-Injunction Act was a jurisdictional provision. By contrast, the challengers to the law offered broader reasons for why the Anti-Injunction Act did not apply. In particular, the challengers argued that their suit did not have, quote, the purpose of restraining, assessment, or collection, because they were not challenging the penalty itself, but only the mandate. Moreover, the challengers argued that there was no need to decide whether the Anti-Injunction Act applied, because it is not jurisdictional and the government had failed to invoke it as blocking the litigation. Now, going into the arguments, one might have thought that the amicus curiae's argument for the applicability of the Anti-Injunction Act could have some traction, particularly with some of the justices more inclined to textualist approaches to statutory interpretation. But that did not seem to be the case, as Professor Johnson will now explain.
Hi, thank you, Kevin. I'm Steve Johnson from the Florida State University College of Law. The Supreme Court held 2 hours of oral argument on the Anti-Injunction Act aspect of this case on Monday, the 26th of March. There are two issues, or two big questions. The first question is, will the court hold that the Anti-Injunction Act bars pre-enforcement review, that is, review right now, of the constitutionality of the individual mandate? And the second issue is, on what ground will the court decide that, especially if it concludes that the pre-enforcement review is not barred by the Anti-Injunction Act? And on the first issue, I feel very good. My view had been, and I've taken this position in print, that although there are very respectable arguments, and it's not a slam dunk by any means, I thought the better answer to the question was that the Anti-Injunction Act does not apply and does not preclude pre-enforcement review of the constitutional issue. And I think that's the position that the court is going to take. I would be astounded if the court does not take that position. 8 of the 9 justices were actively involved in questions in the oral argument, as his wont. The justice who was not significantly involved in the questioning was Justice Thomas. All the other 8 were significantly involved. And one could not detect from any of the 8 a disposition to say, no, sorry, we can't decide this case because of the Anti-Injunction Act. So that, of course, there's no guarantee that what a justice says in questioning is what will make it into the opinion. But I think, given the nature of the way the argument unfolded, it would be a thunderbolt if the court, in fact, did say that the Anti-Injunction Act applied at this point and precluded pre-enforcement constitutional review. So that makes the second question, the one that's really important. On what ground is the court likely to take that view? And I care about that because the principal thing that I teach here at Florida State is tax courses. And the Anti-Injunction Act is an important feature of the tax administration. It does do important things. So my concern was, first, that the issue be decided correctly, but second, it be decided on a ground that doesn't create problems for tax administration in the future. It's much less clear on what ground the court is going to decide that the Anti-Injunction Act doesn't apply. First, as Kevin pointed out, one of the issues is whether the Anti-Injunction Act is jurisdictional or not. As the argument began, there seemed to be a lot of interest on the part of several of the justices in that issue. And it's possible that one or more of the justices will, in fact, take that view in a written opinion. But I think as the argument proceeded, the attachment to that view diminished considerably. And my own guess would be that the court either will not address that issue, whether it's jurisdictional or not, because it'll find a narrower ground for decision, or if it does address it, will hold that the Anti-Injunction Act is jurisdictional. A big part of this is, if one says that it's not jurisdictional, then the lower federal courts would have the ability and, as they've shown in some other contexts, maybe well the willingness to create equitable exceptions to the Anti-Injunction Act. The Anti-Injunction Act itself contains specified statutory exceptions, and then the Supreme Court has created two case law exceptions. The concern would be lower courts would feel free to create some other exceptions, and that could play hob with the useful role the AIA plays. And I think the justices were coming around to that view. In particular, they were looking at the similarity of the language of the Anti-Injunction Act, Section 7421 of the Internal Revenue Code, to Section 7422 of the Code, which deals with refund suits. And the language is very similar. And the court, I think there were some justices who were very concerned with the thought that if they held that the Anti-Injunction Act was non-jurisdictional, same thing could be said about the refund statute, and that would create considerable problems. So I think there could be real danger if the view were taken that the Anti-Injunction Act is not jurisdictional, but I suspect the court will not go that way. Where will they go? I think probably that the government's view of this will be followed. Kevin described the government's view as being focused on intent, and I agree with that, but it's intent as expressed in the language of the statute. The government was making the argument that when you're talking about the Anti-Injunction Act, Congress needs to give clear textual instruction that the item in question, the measure in question, is a tax subject to the Act. So its intent is manifest in the statute itself. And I think that's a narrow ground for decision. If the court takes that narrow ground for decision, I don't see real problem for tax administration in the future. Finally, Kevin mentioned that there were some other arguments that have been advanced by the states and by the private parties. There was really very little interest in those arguments, and I just don't see them as being likely candidates for inclusion in the decision.
This is Kevin. Again, I agree with Steve's breakdown, really, of what happened at the argument and the likely outcomes. From a non-tax specialist perspective, it looked like the court realized that they wanted to get to the issues, but they didn't want to break the Tax Anti-Injunction Act, and so they were searching for the way to do that most narrowly. I agree that the interest they demonstrated in the jurisdictionality of the Anti-Injunction Act was somewhat surprising, but whenever you see a coalition of, say, Justice Scalia and Justice Breyer, for example, who both seem to lean toward the Anti-Injunction Act remaining as jurisdictional, you can be comfortable that there probably not going to be a bunch of other justices out there with very different views. The comforting thing from more of a federal jurisdiction point of view was the rejection or the seeming hostility to the challenger's attempt to say that they could challenge the mandate apart from the penalty. This is important because it ties into the question of standing, whether you can just challenge the regulatory requirement in the absence of some injury that it imposes on you. And skepticism that argument received, say, from Chief Justice Roberts was welcome in these quarters. There were a couple interesting potential spillovers from the jurisdictional arguments into the merits arguments that took place the next couple of days, but by and large, the argument remained focused on the Anti-Injunction Act.
A couple of amplifications. First, when Kevin says Justice Scalia and Justice Breyer coming together, I see that also. And you can add to that then the strain manifest in Justice Ginsburg and some others of trying to decide cases on the narrowest ground. And the narrowest ground would not be that the statute is non-jurisdictional. So you get the coalescence of all these different strands, and I think that's going to be decisive. Also important in that regard is an argument can be made that viewing the Anti-Injunction Act as non-jurisdictional is good for the government because it would then give the government the option of, in particular cases that it wanted to move forward to decision faster, just not raising the argument, waiving the Anti-Injunction Act and letting the case then proceed. So an argument can be made that holding that the Anti-Injunction Act is non-jurisdictional would help the government. When that notion was presented to the government, however, the government said, no, we don't see it that way. And I think the notion that was emerging was that, okay, it's up to the government to define where its own interest lies, and we on the court aren't going to second-guess that. So when you combine that deference to the government's definition of its own interests with the fact that revenue raising is so central to the operation of government at all, I think those are going to be significant factors in how the court chooses to resolve the matter. Kevin also mentioned that there was some spillover between the Anti-Injunction Act issue and the merits. Part of that spillover involved the question of what is a tax? Is the shared responsibility penalty, the enforcement mechanism for the individual mandate, a tax for Anti-Injunction Act purposes? And is it a tax for constitutional purposes in the sense of being authorized by the taxing clause of the Constitution? Tax doesn't have to mean the same thing in both of those contexts, but there's a certain push or certain natural tendency in the direction of saying if it's a tax, it's a tax for both purposes. And there was a strain of that argument. I think the justices who vote in favor of upholding the constitutionality of the individual mandate are quite likely to do that on the ground of the Commerce Clause. There may be one or two who say the taxing clause, but I don't see that as commanding even 4 votes on the court. And I got that impression from this first day of argument.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.